You're listening to the Badass Lady Folk of Brooklyn on Radio Free Brooklyn. I'm your host, Christine Stoddard.
And I'm your co-host, Rose Reed.
Today, we are so excited to have Juliet Kleber.
Yay!
Yay!
Thank you guys so much for having me. I'm so happy to be here.
Yeah, girl.
Basement in Brooklyn. It's like a dream.
Dream come true. Well, today we have Juliet because she went through the huge effort of organizing a fundraiser for ACLU, Planned Parenthood, the Immigrant Justice Center, etc., on the night of the Women's March in New York. That would have been January 21st. It was called This Machine Kills Fascists after the Woody Guthrie Project. And yeah, why'd you do this?
Well, the idea kind of came like pretty much immediately following election night. I was talking with my roommate, who is also a musician and a lady, and sharing in a just mutual sense of kind of hopelessness and horror. And at the time, especially, I was not working, and I was feeling like the most important thing that I could do at that time was like mobilize. Like, I woke up the morning after the election and just felt like a flip had switched in my head, and the idea of not trying to do whatever I could do. So just in like being a person who plays shows independently at like venues around Brooklyn, I do like have some experience like booking my own shows. I know a lot of local musicians who care about the same things that I care about that felt like they would be really relevant in the moment. And it felt like it would be kind of a small way to use the work that we do, like the art that we make, to do something that felt productive and meaningful, just with the tools that we had.
Yeah, that's still, even with those connections and that experience, that's a lot to do. How did you muster that energy and that excitement?
Well, first off, I had like a great partner in organizing this. Is my friend Juno, who is a fellow musician in the neighborhood, and also like a really, really great musician. His band name is Acorns Are Yum. And it's, yeah, he makes just like really like sweet, just completely like lush and infectious, like pop folk music. So I did have help, but also, I feel like I needed it. It wasn't even so much an issue of mustering energy, although like when I started working full time, kind of in the midst of trying to plan this, it definitely became harder, but it just felt like an imperative. Like even when I was exhausted, it didn't really feel like a thing that I could ignore.
So why don't you give us the lineup of what the event was like?
So it was a group of all like independent, pretty small. Actually, my friends Verity Girls, who played the show, are on Manimal, so they are on a record label. But like pretty like small local bands, all of whom just care about progressive causes. The first of the night was Henry Black and Riley Pinkerton, who are a kind of folk, more traditional folk duo. And they are great and write separately but play on each other's songs, which is really interesting. Then it was me with my backing band, which is a violinist, a keyboard player, a guitarist, and a drummer. And then, as I mentioned, my friend Juno with his solo project, and although playing with him that night was Tim of Hat and Boots, and then Verity Girls, who are a three-piece kind of chamber pop band, who are like some of my very close friends who live like a couple blocks from here, actually, and are just like really awesome, like confessionally progressive feminist pop artists, who I know from college.
Well, overall, the night was pretty folksy, like Woody Guthrie, Pete Seeger, kind of.
It's definitely inspired by that. I think my music, and especially like Henry Black and Riley Pinkerton, both kind of play more in the vein of traditional folk music that has kind of clearer roots to that kind of folk activism. But one of the things I was interested in doing this event was using that tradition and drawing that tradition while kind of making room for the ways that like folk music has kind of expanded and evolved. Like, I think my music is kind of, while it is definitely folk, and I would never not call it that, it is a little bit more alternative, and it is a little bit more even compositional or avant-garde. So I definitely wanted to recall that tradition and participate in it, especially because I think that it is kind of neglected, especially in, at least in Brooklyn. Like, I know that there are a lot of places with really strong folk music scenes that always include some form of social activism or consciousness. But I think I was seeing a lot of benefits coming up around the time of the election, and the vast, vast majority, if not all of the ones at least that I saw, were put on by punk bands. And I think that that is really pretty representative of what's happening in the bigger venues in Brooklyn right now, but it's not all there is. And that was one of the things that I was interested in doing this show.
Did you feel that it was important to curate as many female musicians as possible, or people of color, or just different kinds of musicians?
It was always a thing that I had in mind. I'm actually probably going to be turning this into a series. I've spoken with the booker. I'm really, really excited about it. I've spoken with the booker from the venue, and he's interested in doing it. So it seems like it might become a monthly show with like a different single donation cause every month, as opposed to the three that we split between this time.
At Pine Box Rock Shop.
Yeah, at Pine Box. Shrek. Yeah.
Okay.
Which is like part of the reason that we chose that venue was it has like a really good folk room feel, and like it's intimate, but it's not so small that you can't like bring in enough people that you can raise a significant amount of money.
And where is it?
It's off the Morgan L.
Okay.
Yeah. And they also like don't generally charge, it's a cover fee or a room rate, so they let you charge a cover, so all of the money that you raise can go to the places that you want it to go.
Wow.
And so going forward, I definitely do want to put a focus on trying to have this series be as inclusive as possible, putting women artists, queer artists, artists of color to the forefront. It is always something I'm thinking about. It also, this time, came together kind of quickly. So the primary driving force in the people that we chose this time were people whose music we respect, obviously, people who are doing things outside of kind of the dominant mode, punk mode, that's happening in the neighborhood, and definitely people who are committed to progressive causes. And it did end up including a lot of women. My friend Juno is like a person of color, but definitely it's a thing that I will think more about when I'm doing this in the future.
Yeah. Sounds like you had a real whirlwind of a few months, and that day in particular, January 21st, because you went to the march and then you had the event. So could you tell us what you did that day, just waking up, what were you thinking? How did you plan for that day?
I didn't plan for the day, I think, as much as I should have. I was very lucky in that I stopped for and like picked up a bagel on the way, because like I woke up and went and didn't even realize how long I was going to be there. I got to the march at like maybe like 11:30 or noon. I wasn't one of the first ones there, but by the time I'd got there with my violinist who played with me that night. It was already like completely wrapped around 42nd Street.
Yeah.
And like it took us just like a long time to even find a place that we could get in to the crowd. And then I ended up going all the way from, I guess it was 2nd Avenue and 47th Street to Trump Tower, like the whole route of the march.
Mm-hmm.
I wore comfortable shoes and I didn't have time to make a sign, which I was bummed out about, but I was happy for the freedom of movement. And it was just like, I think I've been to like a good handful of marches before. But I think this is the largest one I've ever been at, most certainly. And it was like enthralling and exhausting. And I don't think that the show that I put on later would have meant as much to me if I hadn't gone to it. It just felt really important to be there and like put my body in the middle of it.
Did you go? I went, and
in New York.
Yes, I went in New York, not in DC, which I was bummed about because I'm from that area originally.
Mm-hmm.
But tell me about your DC experience, Rose, lucky duck.
Man, I mean, I went down to DC like on Thursday night so I could be there Friday morning and protest the inauguration.
Yeah,
which was an interesting experience, and I have to also admit that I kept thinking the entire weekend, like, okay, we're present, we're here, but what's next? Like,
right.
What are the actions that are going to come? And I kept talking. I made sure that every person I talked to, I was like, so what are you going to be doing? Like, what are some things you're thinking about doing differently, like, in your daily life, like, at work? Like, you know, uplifting other voices, like, you know, showcasing, like, things that, you know, maybe you haven't thought of before, and, like, expanding your reading list. Like, what are some things you're going to be doing? And, you know, I really appreciated when people, like, posed the same questions to me. D.C. was so crowded, and it was so weird being, because, like, Inauguration Day was, like, really eerie. I was at Barack Obama's inauguration 4 years ago, and it was, like, a loving event. You just felt great energy and, like, a lot of, like, people dressed up, and it was cold, but I, you know, it was very organized. It was very easy to, like, get to the mall and, like, see everything. And the inauguration day itself, Friday, it felt very empty. It felt very, I was like, where is everything? So that was my impression. And I did protest, but that was also kind of strange because I felt like it felt very not... The protests didn't have like a consolidated point, and there was a lot of like anarchists like just throwing shit, and that like really annoyed me because I felt like you're distracting,
right?
But I also understand their point.
Yeah,
it was just like from my point of view, like because I just like saw some instigators, and I was like, we're having such a nice day, you know, but the march itself. More people than I've ever seen in my whole life.
Wow.
Yeah, and I feel like I've been to so many concerts and so many Mardi Gras, so I had the opposite planning of you, Julia. Like, I took a backpack with, like, tissue, snacks, like,
smart.
Gloves, extra socks, you know, ponchos for, like, people, like, some flair. Like, what if people weren't wearing anything? I brought Lay's, like, in case they want something colorful and, like, a little peaceful.
Aww.
I was over-prepared. Like, I'm still eating cashews and dark chocolate that I have. But I was blown away by how many people there were. And I was so impressed with the signs of, like, intersectionality, science, like, all these things. Like, we want to talk about immigration, LGBTQ. Consciousness. And so that, and I heard people asking questions. That was the best part.
Yeah.
What does intersectional mean? That was the best part.
Yeah, I've got to say, I really appreciate the kind of the consciousness and criticism around the Women's March as
such,
like,
a necessary dialogue.
Yeah, like, yeah, how inclusive is this? Like, how does this promote a narrative about women's equality that maybe, like, doesn't highlight black struggle in the way that it should, and like doesn't highlight queer struggle in the way that it should. But also, I was really impressed at the march, the amount of like signage, at least that I saw, like about trans issues and about immigration issues and about just intersectional feminism. And I would imagine that was probably different across the country, but it was like heartening.
Yeah, like my little sister marched in Phoenix, where she lives, and there many of the signs, far more signs than I saw in New York, related to immigration and Latino issues. And it was just fascinating to look on social media, look at mainstream media, look at different kinds of blogs, and see what coverage people were posting from the event. I always feel so conflicted with these kinds of things because I was there covering it and I had to observe. I was there for a Huffington Post Yahoo News thing, and I felt like, okay, well, I'm not allowed to participate. I can't bring a sign, but I'm a woman. And you being a reporter, now that you work for the New Republic, that must have also felt sort of conflicting.
Yeah, I mean, I was there as a private citizen.
Right.
And like, I know like a lot of the rest of the staff was, it's an interesting kind of dilemma. The idea that you have to come into it, at least when you're covering an event, although I was not covering this, as a, like an impartial person, when kind of like one, I think we all kind of know that the, concept of impartiality, especially when it comes to these things, is like not all that possible. But like when you come to it from, you're a woman at the Women's March.
Right.
and like, I know, I was there as an activist and as a woman and as a political person, I guess.
And how does it impact you, think, as a musician?
I think of my music as a tool now in a way that I didn't so much before. I've always been like a very kind of introspective songwriter, and like the content of my music, although it is definitely like informed from a like particularly female perspective, has been really, just kind of the content of my own life. And while I haven't been writing new material so much anymore. I'm in the process of recording now. I have definitely seen this opening, to use like even the small leverage that I have as a musician, as like an independent musician, to raise money, and talk to people about the things that I care about.
What kind of conversations took place the night of the concert? Or were people just letting it all out and dancing, singing?
I mean, I think there was definitely a feeling that, like of gratefulness to have something to do, especially in the evening, like after the march was over. I think a lot of people were feeling really helpless, and a lot of people were feeling, just kind of at a loss. And that was part of why I wanted to do it, is like, if you can't go to DC, you're in New York. Like, here's a way that you can like be in your community, especially like if you are a person who goes to shows a lot in Brooklyn, if you are a person who is a musician, you can, come to this thing and be participating like in some small kind of action in your community. So there was a lot of people talking about just how angry they were and how hard it was, but also like, I don't know, I think there was a real like feeling of like excitement and solidarity.
I have a question. How do you feel, and we can skip it if you don't like it, how do you feel when people voice their anger, voice their disappointment, but admit that they didn't vote?
I don't know that many people who didn't vote, which I feel really
I recently
lucky
went on a
about.
Date with a very smart person, very like loves to read, so like knew more about political stuff than I did, and admitted that he didn't vote.
No.
Yeah.
Did you end the date? Bye. Never again.
My boyfriend actually is the only person I know who didn't vote. Just he couldn't register in time.
Well, all right.
And yeah, I know. And like, I mean, he is in New York, so it's like less egregious than if he was in another state. But like, I know he felt horrible. Like, he didn't leave the apartment for like a full day and a half after the election because he was like, "It's my fault. Like, I am part of the problem." And while like I don't know if that's like quite a valid assessment, yeah, I can't even imagine like how those people must be feeling. And like I know like thinking especially about the people who are like suddenly just like surprised at how bad everything got so quickly but didn't vote. I'm like, we all told you, like he told you, everyone told you.
Yeah. You know what's also strange about like voting is even if you're not registered, you can still fill out an affidavit when you're there. You could still fill out like a paper ballot that can be counted. They can decide if they want to count it or not. And I think a lot of people don't know that.
I did not know that. That's really useful information.
That's how I vote in other like places. Like if I'm in a different district than my own district, I'm like, I'll just fill this out.
I always do absentee. Always, always. Just get it in early. Just not worry about it anymore. It's done.
I was really excited to like go to my, this is the first time I've voted since I've been in New York. The last election I was upstate in Saratoga and like in a, like a liberal arts college situation. So it was very different than voting like in Brooklyn. And I was so excited about it. Like the election day, like I was just so happy. Everyone was just, it seemed like happy. It was like organized and like this like really positive, hopeful atmosphere.
Where did you vote?
I live in Williamsburg, so I voted, I don't remember exactly what my district is, but it's like around the Graham L. And it was like,
oh my gosh, is it an elementary school in Pensilia in Manhattan?
Yeah.
That's my voting.
Yeah. It was nice. Adorable. It was really nice in there.
US 132.
Yeah.
Shout out.
Yeah, I went to the Italian Piadina place afterwards.
That's where I was today.
Me too, actually. I was there this morning.
It's a win-win.
Yeah. And yeah, like the lady who put the my ballot in the scanner like held my hand afterward and we're like, yeah,
you did it. We did it.
We thought we did it.
Oh.
Oh my God, Obama tell us what to do.
Yeah, please. Michelle tells us what to do. Biden tells us what to do.
Well, what do you think that people should do, Juliet?
Oh my God. I had a long argument about this with my family the other night. It wasn't really an argument. It was like a
brainstorm.
Wait, what are their political leftist beliefs?
Oh, they're like very middle class Jewish liberal psychologists.
So you're generally on the same page.
Yeah, we're generally on the same page. We were just having this conversation. It's like, do you focus your energies on grassroots organizing or do you like try and like participate in like a broader change of the like electoral system? And I was like, Dad, like my mom is a social worker, like like how is she gonna change the electoral college? But like she can like go, I don't know, she's like going to these like meetings in our town where I'm from, this like very small village in Westchester, like going to these meetings like with other moms about like trying to make our little village a sanctuary town. And so I don't know, I believe in that. I believe in like really hyper local organizing. I don't know as much about this, but it seems like really essential to me at this moment that we try to spend some of our resources at least on labor rights, like especially one of the like fastest growing occupations in this country is like the home healthcare industry, and a lot of that industry is women of color, especially immigrant women of color, who are particularly vulnerable in this moment, and who are, I don't know, like an incredibly important and underserved part of our working class, and when we talk about
and our healthcare system.
Yeah, and our healthcare system, and like especially as I don't know, the baby boomer generation starts to age.
Hope they get out of the Senate.
Oh yeah, get out.
But Bernie can stay.
There are exceptions. So I think I don't know. One of my like probably possibly naive, but like broad ideas about at least like the kind of conversations we need to be having is like it seems like there's this really strange debate going on about whether like do you talk about like identity politics or do you talk about like white working class voters? And it's like, why do you imagine like that the working class is this like New Deal era factory coalition of
Arch
white
bunker,
men. Yeah. It's not that. It's largely service workers. It's largely women of color. So I think, I don't know, whatever we can do to be allies to those people, like supporting your local unions. And yeah, I guess we're trying to make more inclusive communities, trying to donate money to causes that matter to you, that are run by people who know how to do things better than you might. Like, yeah. I'm very scared about what's going to happen to the Constitution in ways that I'm not fully qualified to address. So I feel really good about giving money to the ACLU.
I'm so glad they're there.
Yeah.
I feel like I took them for granted the last 8 years.
I know. Yeah, I know. And then I guess, I don't know, I've talked about, like, there's looking into networks where you can donate to help women get transportation and childcare for who have to travel long distances to get abortions. Mm-hmm. Yeah, there's a lot that you can do, but it feels overwhelming.
It does. I do think, like, doing something practical, like one thing every day is great. I love this to-do list you just gave me, Juliet. I also found out recently that there's something called swingleft.com, which, like, helps you in a very, like, easy way see, like, what small and local politics seats are up and what you can do to support them, which I think will be great to take it back from these fascists.
Assholes, yeah. So you said that your mom is a social worker, and that's something very hands-on, direct, helping the community, that kind of job. What does your dad do?
He is a clinical psychologist. So they're both mental health workers. My mom is definitely more – she works at a state hospital, though, up at Columbia. So she definitely kind of is – more involved with a more diverse, broad community of people with mental health illnesses who are kind of in a lot of situations relying on public health care. But yeah, both of them are very liberal, progressive, and I am lucky.
Yeah, what kind of conversations are you having about health care when you visit them or call them?
Well, they're both pretty freaked out, especially also in like my dad's case, a lot of his patients, like for their insurance, rely on Medicare. And like, that's a thing that those people could lose.
I'm on New York State healthcare.
Me too.
By the way.
Lots of people are. Yeah.
It doesn't say Obamacare on any documentation, so it is confusing to those who want to destroys policies. So,
yeah, and I think especially my mom knows how vulnerable a lot of people are without healthcare, and not even just from being a healthcare professional, but from being a person who once a lot of these people leave the hospital, they don't have places to live. They don't have jobs. So like a lot of what she does as well is when she's discharging people, finding them places to go where they can get further care, where they can have like a stable living situation.
Basics.
Yeah.
Yeah, my first thought was maybe we should send them to Copenhagen.
Go to Europe.
We have some American refugees. They lost their health care. They're under attack from their government. Do we qualify? This is like our first world question. What Scandinavian countries will take us in?
What do you feel your responsibilities as a reporter are right now?
Well, I am definitely, like, in terms of my organization that I work for, like, the very bottom of the totem pole in terms of...
Yeah, but you still matter. Yeah. You're still important. You can still do something.
I mean,
you're
I'm definitely...
Radio.
Yeah. Here I am.
You're on Radio Free Brooklyn.
Using my platform.
Yeah, get it, girl.
I guess I'm just trying to, like, write about things that are meaningful to me when I have, when I have the opportunity to.
Like what?
I like to believe that writing is a form of activism, I guess. The writing that I've done in the time that I've been there so far has all been kind of for the, like, breaking news type section, which is called Minutes, and it's, like, kind of, it's almost like a blog, but it's, like, pretty rapid reactions to whatever's happening in the moment. And they're very, I don't know, they're funny sometimes, or they're, like, it's, like, a lot of voice. And so I've just been trying to write about things that I feel like I have a particular perspective on. Like, I've covered some of the attacks on Planned Parenthood and their responses to it, and
what's a recent example, a specific attack?
Well, the thing that I was writing about at that point, which was really interesting and odd, when there was a special, like, task force committee thing, like, investigative task force, I'm sure you know about this, that was founded when those, like, completely fabricated and absurd videos came out
from the evangelical Christian production, quote-unquote production company. Yeah.
What were the videos?
They were, like, alleging to show evidence that Planned Parenthood was, like, profiting off of selling
baby parts. Quote-unquote, Planned Parenthood sells baby parts.
Yeah.
So that would have been
Are these the same people who did the childhood porn ring for Hillary? I'm just saying. That was, like, a really dark joke.
Just the same political philosophy, I guess.
Oh my god, times were too hard when, like, sentences come out of your mouth.
Yeah.
would have been the summer of 2015. I remember watching the first video and just being
I couldn't
so
even watch them.
Disgusted. So outraged.
Especially
someone...
because so many women who have had the horrible experience of having to have an abortion, whether for medical reasons or, I don't know, exercising their fucking human right.
Yeah.
just going to, like, scoot that in there. You know, it's like, why put another person through, like, that kind of, you know, bananagram? Like, that's just, it's not real, and it's cruel to do to people.
And they've found, like, very clearly that these videos were doctored in such a way that it's completely fabricated, and, like, even, like, I think they were successfully sued at one point.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. But still, like, our brilliant there was, like, a group of GOP mm-hmm. Congress people who decided that this warranted a task force to investigate. And I think it cost, like, millions of dollars,
right.
And
I mean,
just
is small government at work, right?
Yeah. and it just ended published this, like, crazy many hundred page report, basically, like, recommending that Planned Parenthood lose its funding, and by lose its funding, I mean they would no longer be able to take Medicare or Medicaid.
Right.
So just the latest on the same on the same tact, and, like, in response, Planned Parenthood, like, put out this press release that they're launching this new campaign to, like, try and show both, like, our legislative bodies and the president that, like, Planned Parenthood is popular among, like, a very broad swath of the American population, including some of these people who voted for Donald Trump, apparently.
I bet you one in four women who voted for the 53% of Donald Trump's supporters who were women. The 53% of white women who voted for Donald Trump, sorry. I bet you one in four of them have received services from Planned Parenthood.
Yeah,
it was a very surprisingly large percentage of Trump supporters who supported continued federal funding to Planned Parenthood. And they did a focus group after the election being why and how. And basically there were all these people being I had no idea, or I didn't think he would really do it. And I didn't know about Mike Pence and how bad he is. And so the thing that I was writing about was in my first reaction to seeing that is it Cecile Richards was talking about it in an interview. All of the press releases they put out mentioned that we need people to show their support and show the president that even some of his supporters support Planned Parenthood. And my initial reaction was you cannot count on these people. I'm sorry, you can't count on these people to really put in the kind of effort
give a shit.
I'm
gonna take the devil's advocate tone here and say that I think that if we give Trump supporters more credit for being dynamic and I think that we can give them a space and an opportunity to be I did vote for Donald Trump, but I do believe in these I think that if we're gonna increase the dialogue for white femmes to address their intersectionality, I do think it's time for us to be okay, I get that some people voted for Donald Trump and can support Planned Parenthood. Can we, because I think that, the old school Republican Party was socially moderate. And, maybe let's give them let's let them have a space too.
At least
they
listen.
Vote with us. Maybe that can be part of the conversion process.
My feeling is just that, not that those people aren't dynamic, but that the amount the volume of action of support that it would take to change this movement by the GOP in Congress to defund Planned Parenthood is so entrenched. They have been trying to do this for years and years and years. They have been dogmatic about it. It has not. I can't imagine that even an enormous outpouring of support for Planned Parenthood by these people would change any of these people's intentions in Congress. And I would love to believe that they would be mobilized and that they would call their congresspeople and that they would try to put pressure on the president. One, I don't know if that would have an effect in this case. You see, sometimes it does, with the Office of Congressional Ethics, the amount of just public outcry, it really did change the outcome of that move. But I think here, one, this is so embedded. It has such a, I don't know.
The pro-life movement is very organized, but they're
specific.
Yeah. Yeah, because when that group of people talks about pro-life, they talk about abortion. But if you look at the Vatican's doctrine on pro-life, they're supposed to be against capital punishment too.
Yes.
They're supposed to be against IVF for infertile couples. There's a whole list of other "quote unquote" pro-life issues, and yet abortion is the only one that they talk about. And
I don't hear anyone saying foster care,
right?
Better
care. Right.
I mean, that's pro-life.
Yeah,
right?
You do. Technically, it is part of Catholic doctrine, and many of the other Christian churches would say the same, that we need to have a more comprehensive foster system. We need to have all sorts of options for adoption. But at the same time, many Christian agencies will not let homosexual couples adopt children. They will not let single women adopt children. It's difficult.
it is difficult. One of my theories, and tell me what y'all think, is that talking about Roe v. Wade is just a way to keep women in the kitchen. Because we're talking about something that was, we're fighting. We are marching. We are donating money. We are writing articles about legislation that was passed in 1973. Mm-hmm. They have kept us fucking busy. Are we allowed to say that?
Yeah, we can say anything. Okay. Any word you want.
They're keeping us in the kitchen. How can we move forward and get some other stuff done when we constantly have to come back and have the same, like, you know, conversation every year, every month, every day? We're talking, how is it we're talking about birth control and your right to abortion when you can carry something that's bigger than, like, has more, you know, technology than, like, NASA in your pocket, you know? Like, how are we still, like, you want to have the same conversation, McConnell? Like, I thought can't we move on to something else?
That being said, however, today is the March for Life, right?
You're asking the wrong question.
I think it is.
It's really busy picking out my Pia Dina.
I do know that there's a lot of pro-life stuff going on right now. I'm not sure if today is the March for Life.
I'm not sure. But either way, like, one of the things that I was seeing, the arguments I was seeing around the Women's March was this, like, weird debate about pro-life women wanting to be involved in the Women's March, but feeling marginalized.
No, but there are some feminist Christians. There are feminist Catholics, and some of them would say there actually is an agency in D.C., Catholics for Choice. I interviewed the president a couple of years ago, and she said everyone who works at this organization is affiliated with this organization believes in a woman's right to choose, and that it's completely up to her. But we also believe that Christ is the Savior.
Well, also that, like, I don't know. One of the fundamental like arguments against abortion is that life begins at conception. And while I obviously don't believe that, I would imagine that there are those women who, like, genuinely believe that, but also want to be people who get paid equally at work.
Right. Exactly.
Who also don't want to be assaulted.
The march was not just about abortion. There were so many other issues.
Many.
And it's not a thing that I know I feel like I've made up my mind on. Like, I don't in my heart necessarily know if I believe that you can be a feminist without supporting like another woman's right to choose, but I do see how the issue is nuanced and, like, how it might be harder to answer that question than at least my knee-jerk reaction would be.
My knee-jerk reaction, and I would love your opinion on this, is the numbers show something different. The numbers show that people who believe in this, the people who voted for Trump, a lot of them at one point in their life have had to access an abortion.
Yeah.
And so the reason I find this conversation so difficult is because I find it so hypocritical.
Yes.
And so embedded with shame and taboo. And I'm not saying I'd have the courage to do this, but if every single woman who had an abortion said, I had an abortion, there's no way that we could have this conversation in this country the way that we do.
For sure.
Yeah. No, it's true. I mean, when you look at these anonymous surveys that are conducted among Christian and Catholic women and other different kinds of conservative religious groups, so many of them, and it depends on the survey, you know, but so many of them, especially Catholics, have had abortions because they're raised to believe that they can't go on birth control, they can't use condoms. So once they get pregnant and they find themselves in a desperate situation, they don't want this for themselves, they get an abortion. Because no one taught them how to use a condom or told them, okay, yeah, you can get birth control.
This is Radio Free Brooklyn talking about everything that's really important.
Yeah, good point. Yeah, no. Laughing just because we've talked about so many different things. Since we are talking about religion a little bit, do you mind talking about if you were raised in any particular faith. You mentioned that your parents were Jewish, right?
Jewish.
Jewish.
Yeah, no, they're both, I'm like full on all the way back Ashkenazi Jew, but neither of my parents were practicing. I was like one of the only Jews in my town who did not get bat mitzvahed.
You really are just culturally Jewish.
Yeah, for sure.
And how did you feel about that?
There was like a time when I was more interested in exploring the idea of like Jewish education, I guess. Like I never went to Hebrew school, and I was like always like really interested and curious about like kind of what I missed. But like as I got older, and like my parents both got kind of, they are really interested in mindfulness meditation, and like they were both like big Vipassana people. That's like a large weird theme in my family. I have an aunt who's like a practicing Zen Buddhist and has been for many, many years. That is kind of my larger like spiritual affiliation. I'm not like consistently practicing at this moment. But I think like my spiritual foundation is in kind of Buddhist philosophy, I guess.
How do you think that connects to your views on feminism and just how you live as a citizen of the world?
It's a really interesting thing, actually, because like when I first got to college, I was like studying in school Buddhism, and I was also at the first school that I went to for those first 2 years I was in college. I was a gender studies major. So I was thinking about those things all the time. And one of the things that comes up a lot is like the meaningfulness and meaninglessness of labels, including like if your whole self is made up of parts that are not necessarily permanent, that there is no self, that is like an amalgamation of these temporary pieces, like your body, like your personality, like your karma. What does a thing like gender mean? And the fact is, like, it's useful, it's a category, it's there, it has great significance in many people's lives, but then it is also this thing that, like, when you pull it apart, what is it? Like, we don't know what feminism is. Like there's no one working definition of feminism that like all feminists could agree upon. Like there's no working definition of what a woman is,
and all women can
agree upon, I think.
At the same time, you seem to have this very strong interest in grassroots projects, grassroots movements, and a hands-on, practical side to you. So how do you rectify these two belief systems or approaches?
Well, I mean, I think that's what identities, that's what like words are for, kind of, is like yes, they're kind of unfixable to real things in life, but they're also like so significant in that they like give us these organizing principles. Like I don't know like what like a woman necessarily is, but I know that I am one.
You know it when you see it.
Yeah.
So you, in addition to writing as a journalist and writing song lyrics, speaking of words, you write poetry.
Yeah. Poetry and more nonfiction now, but I...
Nonfiction as in essays, creative nonfiction.
Essays, yeah.
Yeah.
I haven't published any of the like kind of more like free form nonfiction that I've done. And all my poetry also has been in really, I guess I've published in like student publications and stuff like that. But that was my kind of academic training, especially my last 2 years in college. I was at the New School and I was writing research based poetry about the Hudson River for like 2 years I spent pretty much working on that one project, which was a collection about, like, it ended up being like 35 pages long about, from like various like scientific and historical and personal standpoints on the Hudson River.
So there was a political angle there too in terms of environmentalism or not really?
Yeah, there's definitely kind of an environmentalist perspective in that. And I definitely, like, I read and researched a lot about it when I was doing that. But it also, like, just comes from, like, being a person who, like, I've lived on the Hudson River my entire life in one place or another.
Does your poetry ever show some of your feminist beliefs or touch on feminist topics?
Honestly, like, it did a lot more when I was, like, not working on this one project. Mm-hmm. I can't, like, separate out enough of the parts of my identity to be, like, this part of my work, like, comes from a female perspective, but I'm sure that it is in there in some way
because
or another.
You're a female
poet. Yeah. Yeah, it's, like, inseparable from my work. While I think girlhood is also, like, a thing that I can't get away from in my writing, but it's, like...
Can you give us an example of that?
A lot of it was just, like, about what it felt like to be a child and a female child, like, coming of age, I guess, in this particular landscape. And, like, it is definitely, like, a gendered perspective on growing up and on, like, coming into awareness of your body and, like, having a body in a landscape, like swimming in a river. So I think, yeah, I was thinking about girlhood a lot, even if it wasn't intentionally, and I think that's always something that comes up in my work.
Is there a lot of overlap between your poetry and your song lyrics?
Recently, especially, yes. My first album was a lot less kind of image-based, landscape-based. I was also, like, I don't know, younger when I was doing that. At this point, it was
Wait,
a long time ago.
How old are you now?
I'm 23.
Okay, and yeah. So you graduated from college last year?
This year. I took a year off, when I transferred schools.
All right, so you were even younger than you are now.
just thinking about different things, but especially when I, like, really got immersed in the material I was working on for my, like, main writing project, which was about the Hudson, like, I kind of couldn't really stop writing about it. And, like, that's why it ended up being, like, my, like, main undergraduate work, was that, like, I just kept writing poems about the Hudson, and I was like, I guess I'm just gonna write poems about the Hudson now. So I just researched a lot about that, and it has definitely, like, bled over into my songwriting. A lot of the songs that I believe that they're, like, very, very different crafts. Like, I don't necessarily subscribe to the belief that, like song lyrics are inherently poetry. Mm-hmm. But I did have the experience of, like, starting out writing things as poems for this project, and then they didn't really end up working as poems, and then later they turned into songs, and they they worked better in that mode than they did as poems.
Do you think that writing poetry is a different experience for women than it is for men, and if so, how?
I think historically it definitely has been. Mm-hmm. I mean, like, I think women have been, like pioneers of different kinds of poetic expression. Like, I don't know, the most obvious being confessional poetry, yeah. I guess. And, like, I think, I don't know, I think I would imagine it's very different for different kinds of female poets, but, like, I think that there is, like, a real lineage of female poets who are very conscious of their gender in writing. And I think I while I am not like the most explicitly gender concerned poet in my writing, I would like to think that I belong to that tradition.
And what about your songwriting? Where do you see yourself fitting in?
I think I have a similar feeling. There are a lot of people who are more overt about it, especially like in like singer-songwriter traditions and in folk traditions. Like you see people like Tori Amos and like Ani DeFranco who are like very outspoken and very like in their lyrics. Yeah. It's very present. And I think just because my poetry comes from like a much more my poetry and my song lyrics come from like a much more kind of image based way of thinking about things, and so I don't think it comes up as much, but I think everything I do is informed by feminism. Everything I do is informed by thinking about things through a gendered lens, and I think that there are like a lot of really insightful, really talented female folk or folk-oriented musicians who are doing that in really interesting, subtle ways. Like my favorite musician of all time is Joanna Newsom, and she like writes like really kind of subtle but like really powerful just insights about gender like all the time. Like she's but it's never in such a way, I think, that it like makes a blanket statement about like what this experience is, but there's like her writing about her experience of womanhood is like so moving, and like her like subtle examinations of her experiences with men, like kind of like in a patriarchy. And I hope that I can do that someday.
Where can people listen to your music?
So my first album is on Bandcamp, on Juliet K.
Can you spell Juliet?
Yeah, J-U-L-I-E-T, and then the letter K. It's on iTunes, it's on Spotify. You can get it pretty much anywhere. You can come to one of my shows, and I will sell you a CD for $7. I made them myself.
When's your next show?
I'm not sure yet. I think it will be the next one of this fundraising series. So if you want to go to my social media pages, I have an Instagram. I have a Facebook that is, again, Juliet K. You will hear updates. It will probably be at Pine Box Rock Shop, and it will probably be another fundraiser.
What else do you want folks to know about the fundraiser you held on January 21st?
And what can people do next?
Yeah.
What can people do next? I would imagine that like a lot of your listenership is probably pretty engaged people.
We hope. Yeah. Get out there, you bums. Go do something.
Make this world better. We're tired of working.
Yeah.
So I guess
we want to watch TV.
Yeah. You can.
I have Roe v. Wade be a thing of the past.
You can always watch TV.
Wow. True. Well, thank you so much, Juliet. We really appreciate it. You have been listening to the Badass Lady Folk of Brooklyn on Radio Free Brooklyn. I'm Christine Stoddard.
I'm Rose Reed.
Tune in next week.